1800, while exploring the course of the Orinoco River, Alexander von Humboldt found, quote from his journeys, an old parrot that nobody understands, end quote, for it spoke the language of the Atures, an extinct race chased by the Caribs. I take this to be a touching example of linguicide, a parrot as the last speaker of a human language. Several words of the Atures' extinct language were transferred to Humboldt by the parrot, but none of their stories. 200 years later, and according to the data provided by ethnologue, 21% of the non-living languages finds in a stage in which the intergenerational transmission is in the process of being broken, while 13% finds in a stage in which it's no longer possible to transmit the language to the next generation. There is a rate of loss amounting to 6 languages per year. The top 20 languages spoken by more than 50 million speakers each are spoken by 50% of the world's population. Our current literary biodiversity, therefore, is in great peril in terms of the number of languages available for literary purposes. Comparative literature, of course, isn't responsible for this situation, and yet Werner Friedrich's 1960 admonition on that complete programs should be renamed nature literatures is to a great extent still valid today. Let's face it, the inclusion in a complete program of literary works in an endangered language won't solve the problem of that particular language, but it will certainly challenge the neoliberal politics of immediate profit that also rules the acquisition of second languages, as well as power relations which are accomplices to several kinds of discrimination. This critique has been forcefully advanced by scholars who, though not working with languages at risk of falling out of use, claim that their literatures, East, Central, and Southeast Asian, don't get a fair share in comparative literature. In her contribution to the Wertheimer's report, Ray Chou argued that, quote, with India, China, and Japan being held as representative of Asia, cultures of lesser prominence in Western perception, such as Korea, Taiwan, Vietnam, Tibet, and others, simply fall by the wayside, as marginalized others to the other that is the great Asian civilizations, end quote. More recently, Kang Wang has claimed in relation to the translation of Chinese literature and introduction into the English-speaking world that, quote, because the hierarchy privileging Western language literature has become increasingly solidified, Chinese and other non-Western writers cannot enter into the ranks of universal writers without recognition from the West, end quote. Though I certainly agree with such a view, I wonder why a similar claim for languages in Europe hasn't been made as far as I know. Drawing on Cho, I make this claim in the following terms. What about European cultures of lesser prominence in Western reception, the marginalized others to the self that is Western tradition? In an age of multiculturalism and globalization, I assume that such a claim may be easily dismissed as Eurocentric. My interest in literary biodiversity, however, isn't restricted to languages in Europe, but still I wonder why a Eurocentric comparative literature cannot be advocated. Believe me, I'm not trying to be controversial here and sustain Eurocentrism without further qualification at an Institute for Comparative Literature and Society whose founding director is Gayatri Spivak. Neither will I try it at any other venue. A key issue is, of course, the meaning with which Eurocentrism is used. The reminder of my presentation included an analysis of the situation of small European literatures, hence the map that illustrates my topic in the poster, in anthologies of world literature in order to elaborate the idea of a Eurocentric comparative literature. I use the verb include in the past, for this was how my presentation was organized until yesterday, when, while crossing the Atlantic, I realized I had completely missed my point. The reminder of my presentation, therefore, will be more messy than anticipated, for I will share with you some notes I brought during the flight from Madrid to New York and yesterday evening at my hotel room. Hopefully, though less organized, my argument will be more compelling. The element that triggered the drastic change of my paper includes the similarities whereby the concepts of world literature, Weltliteratur, and small literature, kleine Literatur, were coined, which, to my knowledge, have remained unnoticed. Besides having been formulated by the most canonical writers in German of the 19th and 20th centuries, respectively, Goethe and Kafka, both concepts, though sketchily described in their original writings, have attracted enormous critical attention, to the point that contemporary elaborations have actually replaced what was said by Goethe, this is the case of David Damrosch, and Kafka, this is the case of Gilles Deleuze and Félix Guattari. Furthermore, both concepts are included in autobiographical writings, Goethe's Gespräche and Kafka's Tagebücher, whose authorship, both internally and externally, is seriously challenged. The literary success achieved by Johann Peter Eckermann is due to his Gespräche mit Goethe, Conversation with Goethe, which, interestingly, was renamed in several languages to different, in several translations to different languages as Conversations with Eckermann, with Goethe given as the book's actual author. This refracts one of the main lines of force of the work, namely, a Freudian father-son conflict. Correspondingly, the literary success achieved by Max Brod is due to his rewriting of Kafka's Tagebücher, which was seminal for many translations into several languages until very recently, and in which a surplus to the Freudian father-son conflict was obtained by adding Kafka's brief and then Vater, letter to his father, at the end. Last but not least, in Kafka's entries for the last days of December 1911, in which his thoughts on Kleine Literaturen are included, Goethe plays a key role as a counterexample. Whereas in Große Literaturen, I quote from Kafka, literary competition on the greatest scale doesn't have a real justification, for writers with great gifts, such as the case of Goethe, silence at least the majority of cavillers, the liveliness of Kleine Literaturen is much greater, says Kafka. It isn't my intention to argue that Kafka is following Goethe's discussion on Weltliteratur for his formulation of Kleine Literaturen. Actually, the main reference for Kafka in this section of his journal is Goethe's Wahrheit und Diktum, in which the idea of world literature is not discussed. What I am trying to suggest is that both previous and current ideas on world literature may be productively challenged if approached from Kafka's Kleine Literaturen. Let me clarify where I locate world literature within this picture. When in 1858 René Wellek diagnosed the crisis of comparative literature, the solution adopted by Henri Remarque 3 years later didn't aim to solve the methodological problem pinpointed by Wellek, but merely extended the scope of the discipline from the interliterary axis to the interartistic and interdiscursive axis. Interestingly, the history of comparative literature during the second half of the 20th century and the first decade of the 21st century didn't follow the path of Remarque's new axis, but implemented the traditional one, the interliterary, in three consecutive waves: East-West studies, postcolonial studies, and more recently, world literature studies. These three waves share the aim of overcoming the pervading Eurocentrism of comparative literature by including new literatures, among which minority literatures played and still play a key role. And yet, neither such an openness and inclusiveness nor the status of minority have been applied to literatures in Europe. The legitimate fight against Eurocentrism, therefore, has as one of its victims precisely those literatures that Eurocentrism itself had first erased from the literary map. For, as Robert Butler put it, Eurocentrism as a practice operated and still operates both inside and outside Europe. This non-place of European minority literatures is conspicuous in the Norton, Lockman and Bedford anthologies of world literature, which have been instrumental for the re-emergence of world literature studies. As for critical studies, except for Christopher Prendergast's introduction to debating world literature, in which the issue of small literatures is mentioned in passing but in a thought-provoking way, other studies either remain silent, as Dan Roche what is world literature, or reinscribe a local model, the French regions, into the whole world, as Pascal Casanova's The World Republic of Letters. In what follows, I will sketchily present the case of a European small minority literature, and finally I will provide some concluding remarks on the possibility of rethinking world literature from Kafka's Kleine Literatur. The various ways in which Kafka's concept has been translated, in contrast to Goethe's Weltliteratur, show the existence of competing and even contradictory understandings. This is in sharp contrast to what actually is a cognate concept in sociolinguistics, namely minority language. For the sake of clarity, let me state that my understanding of Kleine Literatur follows a sociolinguistic approach, whereby the distinction between majority and minority groups is not based on numerical size, but on clearly observable differences among groups in relation to power, status, and entitlement. In 1877, Max Adler predicted that Euskera, or Basque language, will go extinct by the last third of the 21st century. Today, Euskera has around 1,720,000 native speakers in Egoalde, the southern or Spanish Basque country, Navarre, and Iparralde, the northern or French Basque country. This number increases to 1,100,000 if speakers who can read basic texts written in Euskera are included. As you know, the Committee for the Nobel Prize in Literature commissions ad hoc translations when there is no member competent enough to appreciate, or when there has not been an English, French, German, or Scandinavian translation of a shortlisted work. The jury for the Premio Nacional de Literatura, National Prize for Literature, convened every year by the Spanish Ministry of Culture, follows the same protocol, except that instead of the linguistic complexities faced by the Swedish Academy, according to the Constitution of 1978, the possible languages for works nominated for the Premio Nacional are but four: Spanish, Catalan, Galician, and Basque. And works are always translated into Spanish. In that sense, the explicit recognition of the plurilingual and multicultural dimension of the state made in the preamble to the call for nominations for the Premio Nacional regarding the different Spanish languages seems paradoxical. For many, that adjective would not be strong enough, and they would link that operation with the Castilian centrism that still prevails in the conception of the state and counts as one of the most resounding failures of the heralded transition to democracy. Of course, there are many arguments in favor of this view of the facts. Illustrative in this respect is the case of the Premio Nacional awarded in 1989 to Bernardo Achaga for Obabacuac, a collection of tales, some previously unpublished, published in Basque in 1988. The author himself has said that it was not until the second call by the critic Mercedes Montmain on behalf of the jury for narrative that he took seriously the request that he translate part of the work so that the jury could judge it. The award of the prize was, therefore, indissolubly linked to that self-translation to Spanish which was published in 1989, as is no less importantly the author's international renown, since many translations of his work to extra-peninsular languages were based on the Spanish version. A review of the list of prizes awarded to works originally written in languages other than Spanish shows that this case is not unique. We find other self-translations with the 1986 prize winner Alfredo Conde's Chavay o Grifón Novento, translated into English as The Grifón, and the 1995 prize winner Carme Riera's Dins el Darrer Blau, translated as In the Last Blue. Obviously, it is not my mission here to enter into the motivations behind each one of these self-translations and their role in the recognition of the minor writer, though I must point out that there has been little research done in the field in the Iberian Peninsula. What I would like to highlight here is the fact that the national canonization that the prize involves operates via a Castilianization that we can only recognize when we contrast the original and final versions. I am not referring exclusively to general linguistic transformation, nor to stylistic elements derived from the passage from one language to another, but also to other transformations within the work, which are manifested most notoriously through the inclusion of second-degree paratexts. With this term, I am referring to those textual pieces of information that present the text to the reader, as argued by Gerard Genet, but which are second degree in the sense that they claim to cross the distance between the original and the final text. Within the final text, the paratext enjoys that status, but when it is compared to the original text, it takes on the condition of second degree, either by its very existence, since it does not exist in the original text, or by replacing or adapting a paratext conceived for the original audience. In either case, the goal of the second degree paratext is to adjust the text to the new audience and the new audience to the extra-systemic text. But seeing that a contrastive reading of the original and the final text is not a common practice, this Castilianization is not noticed by the average Spanish-speaking reader, nor by the speaker of a non-peninsular language reading a translation based on the Spanish version. This fact is conspicuous in Obabacuac, with the authorial paratext incorporated into the Spanish translation under the title of A Modo de Autobiografía, by way of autobiography. The typeset intentionally blurs the borders between the tales, the text, and the paratext to the point that A Modo de Autobiografía can be read, and actually is read, as one more tale among the many metaliterary references that make up the work, from the dialogue of the narrator with Pedro de Aguirre, Achular, to the famous tale Para escribir un cuento en 5 minutos, How to Write a Story in 5 Minutes. In this second degree paratext, Achaga declares, quote, I read Gabriel Aresti at 20. 3 years later, at 23, I had finished reading all the vast literature that the dictator had not managed to burn, end quote. Regardless of the factual correctness of the reference to Franco, which doubtless plays with the convention of magical realism and presents him as a figure of Comala or Macondo, there is no doubt of the desired impact, unnecessary in the case of the Basque audience, on the Spanish audience of the record of a literature that can be read in all its entirety in 3 years. Thus, we have the motif of a small literature, thematized in a hermeneutic experience impossible for the audience of major literatures, and I assume impossible for most of your experiences with literature. Some sociological reference for this experience are, between 1545 and 1879, 101 books were published in Basque, of which only 4 are literary. Euskara Batua, Unify Basque, did not come about until 1968 with the meeting of the Euskalsaindea, the Basque Academy of Letters in Arantzazu. and the Association of Bass Biters currently holds a total of 325 affiliated authors. Faced with this scene, it makes sense that another one of Achaga's preferred minor images included in this second degree paratext is The Game of the Goose, which is offered as a model for the Basque literary space. I quote from Achaga, "A writer who started writing in euskera in the 1970s looks a lot like the teenager pictured on the first of the 63 squares of the board, who carries nothing but a bundle with his possessions." To extrapolate the mythical geography of Obaba to the cartography of the Basque literary system does not seem to go too far. The G's from The Game that tells of the birth of the Basque writer fly over Obaba and are even its narrators, while the literary premodernity represented by the sentimental landscape has its focus of tension in Hamburg, representing literary cosmopolitanism, and to a lesser extent in Barcelona, seat of the publishing houses that produce the Spanish translations of Achaga's works. The aspect of general Castilianization of the Premios Nacionales to which I am referring, as perceptible in second degree paratext, shows that the dual process of adjustment mentioned earlier requires foreignizing on the part of the Spanish audience and exotization on the part of the extrasystemic work. Good proof of this is that Achaga's paratext persists in extra-peninsular versions through the Spanish translation, which makes the Spanish, but also the French, an audience as foreign to Basque literature as the English, American, German, and Greek, to name but a few. There is nothing more significant on this point than the culinary metaphor used by Eugenio Suarez Galván Guerra in his review of the English translation of O Baba Quack, published in the June 20th, 1993 issue of the New York Times Review, which describes the book as a delicious literary paella. O Baba Quack is celebrated. Quack is celebrated as the regional, though certainly not Basque, dish that foreigners consider most typically Spanish. Of the various modern literatures in the Iberian Peninsula, Basque is assuredly the one that has applied with more insistence and devotion to its self-definition as a small literature. As we know, Kafka's thoughts on kleine Literaturen, a concept unfortunately translated as minor literatures and not as small literatures, were further developed by Gilles Deleuze and Félix Guattari, whose formulation was privileged by critics even in the peninsula. Thus, John Juaristi does not hesitate to propose not all Basque literature, but rather that produced in the dialect of Bilbao as the epitome of minor literature. I quote, "Minor literatures," quoting from Juaristi, "minor literatures always propose alternate canons, promoting in the foreground minor or excluded literary uses. Revolutionary or reactionary, they are always subversive. 10th of the century Bilbao offer the necessary conditions so that a literature of these characteristics could emerge and take root," end quote. This minor literature would be constructed as an alternative as compared to the counter-canonical, which is in this moment the 1898 generation, and nationalist, as represented by Sabino Arana and Resurrección María de Ascue, options at the end of the 19th century. Juaristi's proposal obviously implies that we accept the Deleuze and Guattari's characterization of minor literature in a chiasmatic relation with major literature. I am quoting now from Deleuze and Guattari, "A minor literature doesn't come from a minor language. It is rather that which a minority constructs within a major language," end quote. In the Basque case, this situation applies to a literature produced in Bilboan, defined by Juaristi as a dialect of the Castilian spoken in the Basque country. It is striking that this definition omits any reference to the bilingual history of Bilbao, whether to emphasize a majority of euskera speakers or to deny it the city and Euskaldun character. Therefore, this Bilbaon developed in the bosom of a major language, Spanish, is formulated as the territorialized equivalent of the German spoken by the Jews of Prague, as said Deleuze and Guattari, appropriate for strange and minor uses, which implicitly relegates Euskera to an identical position with Czech. I will leave out the fact that Deleuze and Guattari omit completely any reflection on the role of this last language, Czech, in the development of Prague German as the instrument of a minor literature. I could say the same of Juaristi and the role of Euskera in the development of Bilbaon, as I have indicated, to point out that this view of Bilbaon situates Euskera in an exclusively nationalist orbit, in keeping with the initial typology of literary alternative presented by Juaristi. I quote, Basque writers born around the 1870s were faced with three different options: actively participating in the subversion of the national canon, creating a nationalist literature in the vernacular, or imagining a minor literature, end quote. Nonetheless, the information that he himself provides allows us to see that the situation is much more complex than his typology would admit. In this respect, the fact that Bilbaon literature disappeared when it lost the support of the nationalist implies that up to a certain time it was also a model for that literary alternative, as Castilian and Bilbaon monoliterariness, or Castilian Euskera biliterariness, were nationalist. Regardless of Juaristi's proposal of Bilbaon literature as minor literature, it is certain that Basque literary history made a spatial limitation into a sign of identity for its literature, a conception of a small literature that privileges territorialization, while Deleuze and Guattari deny it. In fact, this conception is much closer to Kafka's original one, and I'm quoting now from his journal from the entry for December the 25th, 1911. The narrowness of the field, the concern too for simplicity and uniformity, and finally the consideration that the inner independence of the literature makes the external connection with politics harmless, result in the dissemination of literature within a country on the basis of political slogans, end quote. This difference is surely due to the fact that Deleuze and Guattari neglected a very important fact. It is the Jewish Yiddish language literature of Warsaw and Prague that inspire Kafka's reflection in terms of national literature, and not the German language literature of Prague, as Juaristi also claims. Basque literary history has also stressed the inadequate territoriality of Euskera and its gradual reduction, which bears witness to the conceptual view of the literary space as small literature, though never as a minor literature in the bosom of Castilian as a major language, an intense territorialization which is maximized via linguistic and therefore literary insularity. Theorized with historical linguistics, the concept of language isolate as a language devoid of a genetic relationship with any other language gave a special depth to the meta-geography of insularity developed by Basque literary history: absolute isolation. The distinctive trait of Basque literature is its development in insular isolation, due to a lack both of its own clan, normally guaranteed by language family, and of the possibility for neighborly communication, motivated by Indo-European difference. Thus, it is relegated to the enigmatic company of languages with no genealogy, 40, according to ethnologue, whose uniqueness resides in the fact that the language itself is the genealogy. Sabino Arana's Euskadi was none other than the people who speak Euskera. In literary terms, this isolation refracts the singularities of the audience. The reading public is proportionally much smaller than the number of writers, and mediation. There is a notable imbalance between the large number of works translated into Euskera and the small number of works in Euskera that are translated into other languages. Other factors that should be taken into consideration are authorial insularity, meaning unnecessary national representativeness and monumental insularity, which makes every work a milestone in literary development, in large part because criticism does not seem possible in small literatures. In that light, consider the following words of John Cortázar in relation to the panorama of vast literature in the year of Achaga's national consecration, that is 1929. I quote from Cortázar. A literature in which almost everything appears and presents itself as decisive in the course of the history of the literature. Without elaborating further, two works published this year have earned from the generous and friendly Basque critics the name of decisive works, end quote. Both insularities bring us back to another modulation of Kleine Literaturen, this time developed by Milan Kundera through the simile of the family. I quote from Kundera, a small nation resembles a big family and likes to describe itself that way. What handicaps their art is that everything and everyone, critics, historians, compatriots as well as foreigners, hooks the art onto the great national family portrait photo and will not let it get away, end quote. And now I come to my concluding remarks. Since the publication of Gilles Deleuze and Félix Guattari's Kafka pour une littérature mineure in 1876, Kafka's concept and characterization of Kleine Literaturen has disappeared under the pressure of Deleuze and Guattari's concept and characterization of Literature mineure. In the long history of the rewritings of the Tagebücher, this process already started with Marc Robert's 1954 translation into French, which has sized the market until now, and where Kleine Literatur is rendered as Literature mineure. Interestingly, Deleuze and Guattari don't quote a single passage from Kafka in which the concept of Kleine Literatur is used. This has proved to be instrumental in the equally foundational translation of Deleuze and Guattari's book into English by Dana Poland in 1986, for the English translation of Kafka, Tagebücher by Joseph Kresch, is based upon the first edition by Max Brod, in which the long section on Kleine Literaturen isn't included, while other occurrences of the concept are phrased as literature of small peoples in the English translation. As François Cousset stated in 2003, French theory, including Deleuze and Guattari's Kafka, was instrumental since the late 1970s for the development of minority and subaltern studies in the US. 2 years before, Silver, Lottinger, and Sam Cohen had elaborated on the concept of French theory by arguing in their book, French Theory in America, that French theory, quote, is an American invention, going back to at least the 18th century, end quote. And yet, concerning Lottinger and Cohen's volume, Rachel remarked, quote, that what made me curious, I must admit, was not so much French theory per se, but what the contributors thought about the connection in America, end quote. It is my contention that one thing here seems to have been neglected. A good deal of what is being called French theory comes, in fact, from Eastern Europe. Let me now come back to my initial defense of a Eurocentric comparative literature. It should be obvious by now that I am not advocating in any way either a view of the world from a European-centric perspective of or the universalization of European standards. I think we all agree in that this is a common way of defining Eurocentrism, which, when applied, has resulted in the suffering of large portions of the world. As famously defined by Samir Amin, we are dealing with a theoretical Eurocentrism, according to which, in literary terms, universalistic values are attached to generalizations that don't comply with the reality of non-European literatures, and, I would add, to the reality of European literatures that don't form part of the core of the idea of European literature. But an entirely different thing is a methodological Eurocentrism, as posited by Desiderio Navarro, which I redefine as the concentration, but not restriction, on the study of the European centrism, a category of a heuristic, problematic, and fluid kind. The fight against the understanding of Eurocentrism, in Ella Sohat's and Robert Stamp's words, as common sense, philosophy and literature are assumed to be European philosophy and literature, the best that is thought and written is assumed to have been thought and written by Europeans, end quote, should step up from both outside and inside Europe. Provincializing Europe can't be equal to ignore the power relationships between the many languages in Europe. A Eurocentric comparative literature which aims at studying the many literatures in Europe has therefore to deconstruct from within historical and essentialist concepts of Europe. Small literatures are key for such a aim, provided one understands that small, minor, minority express a relation. They are dynamic concepts rather than static, and pinpoint that all languages in specific situations are potentially small, minor, minority languages. Otherwise, we will remain trapped in the improductive polarization that goes from pour une littérature mineure to pour une littérature monde. Thank you very much.
Do we have questions for César? I do have a question. I have like 10 questions, but I am going to try to concentrate on just one. It's just a matter of clarification, because I might have misunderstood you or missed the point, perhaps altogether, which, you know, it's something that happens to me quite often. But one of the arguments is how to interpret the kleine Literatur kind of concept and how to divide it from the way of the Literatur mineure, de l'Ezegatari. And it occurred to me that perhaps, I am not sure, just a question for you who know better than I do, but perhaps Deleuze and Guattari didn't want to translate Kleine Literatur at all. That they actually wanted to do something completely different, entirely different, by using some sort of evocation of that Kleine Literatur, mm-hmm. and mobilizing a concept that is quite interesting precisely because it's linked to something that you have mentioned in the end of your talk, which is the dynamic character of the minor literature insofar as the la littérature mineure, it's intimately linked to the la pensée nomade, to the becoming. It's the fact that it's not that you are in a minor literature unless you become that sort of minor literature. So perhaps, I don't know if this somehow is something that you wanted to yes. mention or not, or it was or you think is problematic or not in this.
Sure. I completely agree with you in the sense that Deleuze and Guattari had a completely different aim than using the concept of Kleine Literatur to analyze Kafka. I think the project was much, much bigger than that. Mm-hmm. And this may explain why they didn't even need to quote a single passage right. from Kafka's right. Journal. The problem is, the point I was trying to make is that I see very problematic when Deleuze and Guattari are read precisely in the sense of analyzing Kafka's
concept. As if they were translating that particular concept.
Yes, and then it's been applied by critics, for example, to the case of the Basque literature, through the reading of Deleuze and Guattari, completely changing the parameters which we find in Kafka journals as regards the situation of German in Prague, Czech, Yiddish, proposing a kind of parallelisms with the Basque situation, which are completely out of the picture. So I completely agree with the fact that the Lesson Watery project, it's much broader than simply analyzing Kafka, but they have been canonized by critical theory in a way that it has made unnecessary to come back to Kafka.
All right, I see. So I have another question, but I don't want to monopolize. So if you have other questions, I can wait, or I can, you know, not say anything at all.
I have a question. I was, thank you for your talk. I was fascinated. I was also remembering myself a long time ago, like being a being involved in the Galician literary system. A little bit, like, and I remember it was a struggle to think of the works of these kinds of writers like Achaga or Manuel Rivas or Kim Munzo. But it was a struggle more than from a kind of linguistic point of view. It was a sort of a political struggle, because we were seeing, I mean, of course, as a new generation, we were seeing the dependency kind of relationships that were established with the Spanish literary markets and El País and of course El Grupo Prisa and all these sort of kind of powers that you were mentioning before when you were talking about how Bernardo Achaga is so linked to like to Barcelona and the editorial system, and how these kinds of writers are always making the literature very clearly viable, economically viable, in Spanish, even if they make a kind of point d'honneur publishing before in their own vernacular languages. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking of how would you define in a kind of a political way this sort of kind of micro dependencies or this kind of cosmopolitanism because it was a concern and I know it's a concern for readers and literary critics in those in at least as far as I know in Catalonia it is and in Galicia. Maybe it's too broad
really,
of a question.
No, really tough question. To start with, I'm not that sure that a traditional understanding of cosmopolitanism would be ready to include minor literatures, minor cultures within within its aims, in the sense that it seems that as for languages, language competence, we used to associate cosmopolitanism with being fluent in major languages. So what I find interesting is that how these peripheral literatures negotiate with such an understanding of cosmopolitanism and question it from within. For example, I find, to come back to Achaga's case, I find interesting that depending on the translation you are reading of our quacks, I mean, for example, the English translation, the Spanish self-translation by Achaga, or for example, the Italian translation, they are kind of composite products. So that a common reader, an average reader, which only reads by because he or she is interested in the work, is not going to receive all the information that a specific translation requires. For example, for the Italian and for the English translation, Achagas include a prologue in the form of a poem where he justifies how, okay, the vast country is so small that it's being difficult to find it even in the map. But that doesn't mean that relationships between the Basque and culture and other cultures hasn't been established. Mm-hmm. And for example, for the English, for the Italian translation, for example, he includes a verse in the poem where he says, "Okay, I forgot the word for Italian word for rainbow is arcobaleno, which has which in Basque is the bridge of Rome. So he argues how Basque literature has a relation to Italian literature, whereas in the English translation he replaced this verse and by using another it, where he shows the relationships between Basque and English. So it's a kind of commodifying the product to adapt it to different settings.
Yeah.
But I am not sure if I am answering your question.
Yeah, I think, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I see what you're...
So, just another curiosity is if you want to elaborate on this or not. But in the economy of languages in the Iberian Peninsula,
mm-hmm.
and so we talk normally about a very small number of languages, and you talked about a very small number of languages. But the languages historically linked mm-hmm. and permanently spoken from Belle Lurette. The number of languages spoken in the Iberian Peninsula is amazingly big,
mm-hmm.
right? And so there is kind of another separation between those minor languages and official languages,
mm-hmm.
which creates a completely different question, probably equivalent to what happens with some of the official minor languages in Spain to those same official languages when they become non-official in France, for instance, mm-hmm. like in the Basque Country, mm-hmm. or in El Rousseau, or mm-hmm. in other places, right? And when you look at this, at the relationship between the economy of languages and of the minor versus official languages, and the economy of literatures and minor versus official literatures, you also see some interesting movements that would perhaps also challenge some of the ideas of a Deleuze Guattari. And I'm thinking, for instance, of Najat al-Hamshmi and L'Ultim Patriarca,
mm-hmm.
which is a Moroccan writer who decides to write a novel in Catalan,
mm-hmm.
Jordan Bishop Catalan, she's
mm-hmm.
also Catalan. And so how do you look at all this other separation, at all this other economy of minor versus official, this movement from the non-official to the official, even if it is a minor,
mm-hmm.
which becomes some sort of major
mm-hmm.
language with our words, with an institution, with a government, etc.
Mm-hmm. My answer is that I look at all this complex situation comparatively. which is something that can be said here. I mean, Columbia University or the state in general, but not in the Spanish academia. Meaning that, when you see how comparative literature is practiced in Spain, you would find that very few scholars are interested in analyzing relationships between Spanish literature, meaning literature written in Spanish, with other Iberian literatures, not even Portuguese literature, at least from, let's say, modernity onwards. The situation is different in the case of medieval Iberia, of course. And then when you look at how comparative literature is practiced by scholars who have as their field of expertise one of the peripheral literatures, they were like, for example, in comparing Catalan literature and Italian or French or English, but not in a sort of inter-Iberian inter-Iberian perspective. I think it was like around 8 years ago. I don't think the situation has changed that much. A scholar from the Netherlands carried out a survey among university professors teaching literatures in Iberia, and asked them what perspective they would privilege. And 98% sticked to the national perspective. And the comparative one was absolutely residual. Which I think that it has to do with the different levels of national historiography, meaning that, for example, I assume that scholars who are kind of traditionally specialized in Galician or Basque or Catalan literature wonder, well, we have just started writing national literary histories, and you want us to go to the next step, they think they are not ready yet, because these literary traditions don't have the historiographic repertoire, or at least the historiographic repertoire as solid as the Spanish one. The case you mentioned of Nayat El-Hajmi is absolutely interesting, because she was awarded the Ramon Llull Prize, which is kind of the national Catalan prize for literature. There was kind of very hot debate on that prize being awarded to well, she's from Morocco. From Morocco, but she emigrated to Spain, I think, when she was 8 or 6 or something like that. Taking into account that the Premio Ramon Llull is awarded by Planeta, and not by the Generalitat, but by the Govern d'Andorra, because it's the only place where Catalan is the official language. So it's a kind of a very interesting situation. And this also applies to other migrant literature, migrant writers from Morocco who decide to choose Catalan as their literary language. What happens when they are translated into Spanish? An interesting case is Laila Carrús, because her book is a kind of journal and was chosen as a kind of compulsory reading for high school students. You find that whereas the original work in Catalan is set in Vic and in Catalonia, and with all the references to the experience of a migrant who has to learn two languages, Catalan and Spanish, the Spanish translation erase all references to Catalonia. So you have a migrant who have migrated to Spain and has no linguistic conflicts, and she doesn't have to learn two languages and so forth.
All right. Shall we thank César for his talk? Thank you very much. And thank you all for coming.
Ah, y te van a poner en el canal de...